I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/recommend today.
T-Mobile has invested billions to light up America's largest 5G network, from big cities to small towns, including right here in yours. And great coverage is just the beginning. Right now, families and small businesses can save up to 20% versus AT&T and Verizon when they switch. Visit your local T-Mobile store today.
Plan savings with 3 lines of T-Mobile Essentials versus comparable available plans. Plan features and taxes and fees may vary.
Baseball is back, and so is MLB.tv. Watch every out-of-market, regular season game on your favorite streaming devices. Anywhere, anytime, all season long. Follow the action live or on demand. Track 4 games at once with multi-view mode. And catch up with in-game highlights. Plus, original programs, minor league broadcasts, and local pre- and post-game shows. Go to MLB.tv to start your free trial today. Blackout and other restrictions apply. Major League Baseball trademarks used with permission.
Welcome to Health Matters with Fred Bottomer on the voice of St. Louis, KMOX.
Hi there, and thanks a lot for joining me again today. I really do appreciate it. Hope you're having a great weekend. Lots to talk about coming up over the next hour, including a closer look at actress Olivia Munn's battle with breast cancer and the test used to alert her to it. We'll also hear about colorectal cancer screening, and we'll look back at the 4-year anniversary of COVID being declared a pandemic. But first, let's start the show the way we always do with our co-host, Dr. Fred Buchholz. Dr. Buchholz is a SLU care general internist at SSM Health St. Louis University Hospital. Dr. Buchholz, thanks a lot for joining us again.
Yeah, Fred, it's always my pleasure.
Good to talk to you. So I'm hearing that the FDA has approved the first over-the-counter continuous glucose monitor, and a lot of people are excited about that. What do you know?
Well, yeah. So, I mean, I think these are tools that have been around for a little bit where, you know, essentially they're checking your glucose, and it's a kind of a constant. So, you know, when I was a resident and when I was a doctor in training, you know, the way we'd have patients check their glucose is they'd have to prick their finger. We'd ask them to do it once or 3 or 4 times a day. You know, we'd try to time it around meals so we'd see what things were doing. And in the last 10 years or so, these monitors have really come into the fold and have been used for patients. It's kind of a burden because you have to get them approved through insurance, and it takes some time. And you know, there's some places where they'll pay for it, some where they don't, and blah, 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 blah. But we have found that when you do that, we are able to better kind of dose, particularly a drug called insulin that's used for a number of diabetics, and you know, maybe prevent overdoses with it and under treatment in other scenarios. So, you know, I think the fact that it's now available basically over the counter, so it means you can go to a store and buy one, I think ostensibly that's a good thing. I think that gets rid of some of the red tape we have of, you know, trying to get insurance approval. The most annoying thing is really not buying the monitor, but the supplies that have to be prescribed as well too. So it's like, it's kind of tedious to do that from my end, and not my favorite thing to do by any stretch. So I like that, you know, I like the idea that they're freely available. The double-edged sword problem with this is that, you know, people that don't have diabetes are certainly going to use it. There's a lot of blogs and wellness kind of influencers that kind of talk about continuous glucose management as a way for looking at their metabolism or thinking about diet. And, you know, there's some interesting science around that, and I think some may know what they're doing, and it might have some benefit. But, you know, these are things that turn into like a phone call for me or a message about, you know, my sugar's been doing this. What does it mean when I don't have diabetes? And my short answer is like, we don't know. I don't know what to do with that information. And, you know, I think there's going to be, you know, misinformation out there that leads to health problems for people too, that will have to be sorted out. So, you know, I think essentially this is a good thing, but, you know, I still think this is an unproven technology for those that don't have diabetes. You know, I think the clear thing is like people have a lot of different kind of physiologic rhythms, and we don't know what all that means just yet. And so I think that's where people may get in trouble with that. If you don't have diabetes, if you saw me, I'd be like, I'm not sure what to make of all this. And that's me being honest, and I'm not sure many physicians do.
People really check their glucose even when they don't have diabetes?
Yeah, it's a thing. You know, so like some of the podcasts I listen to, I've had people talk about this and what it says to their diet, to their exercise routines, et cetera, et cetera. There's a couple of doctors that have talked about doing like bone density studies quite a bit. And, you know, it's nice when it kind of works in the niche. You know, I have millions of excess dollars that I can spend and different way to do this type of stuff. But I live in a world where patients that have a hard time affording the medications they have or the roof over their head. So it's a different world than mine. And I think it just leads to some confusion because, again, it's, you know, there's probably times where you have spikes in sugar that are perfectly normal. It may be a response to stress. It may be because you had a breakfast of Belgian waffles. It doesn't really necessarily mean anything unless there might be circumstances where it does. I just don't know the answer to that. And I don't think science knows the answer to that just yet. So that's where I have concerns.
Let's talk about vitamin B3. I saw a study that says excess use of vitamin B3 is linked to increased risk of heart disease. What do you know about vitamin B3? And is that a pill?
Yeah, it's a pill, Fred. And it's a drug. I mean, it's also, you may hear it called niacin. So, you know, again, going back, I always have to preface this when I say this, Fred. I'm not that old, but, you know, I was a resident in, you know, the late 2007, 2010. Niacin, we often use that to correct the good cholesterol. So if like you had, the good cholesterol is HDL, and if you had low HDL, if we gave you niacin, it raised your HDL. Then there was a pretty big trial that was done to look if niacin actually improved cardiovascular disease. And it was stopped early because it frankly didn't. In fact, there was a concern it might actually cause more harm. So, you know, it's still a supplement. There's still people that take it. So this was like looking at people that took it as a supplement, and there is a concern for excess risk of having heart disease. Again, these are the type of trials that it's hard to know because there's a lot of like confounding pieces of information in this. But niacin would not be something I would ever recommend that people take. It's fortified in a number of different products. So like, you know, I think flour is fortified with niacin. So like the average American diet is not going to have a deficiency in niacin. And I've never recommended it. I never will. And if you haven't gotten my vibe yet, Fred, I hardly recommend any kind of supplements for this very reason. We really don't know the isolated effects. They're really all components of what I would call a robust and nutritious diet. And that's how I think you should get all these different vitamins. That's why they're essential. And that's what we're, you know, kind of created to do. That's what we evolved to. We've evolved to eat plants and foods, not pills.
So no vitamins, even a multivitamin?
Yeah. I mean, a multivitamin just makes your pee more expensive. You tend to urinate out most of your multivitamin that you take. I'll save you the diatribe, Fred, of vitamin D, but my residents are very familiar with me ranting about this. And, you know, really, basically, there's no supplement that's around. And it's kind of interesting, Fred, in medicine, every vitamin kind of has its day in the sun. So, you know, 20 years ago, vitamin A was the vitamin du jour, and vitamin E for a while, then vitamin D. And then it's a subject of a lot of research and study. And essentially, when you look at the supplementation of any vitamin, vitamin C is another one. Once you really kind of do good research, it just kind of filters away. So classic example is vitamin C. This guy, I think he was at Wake Forest, but don't quote me on that. But he had a bunch of research showing vitamin C helped patients that were in the ICU. And then, you know, so everybody was kind of on board with that and using it. And then a couple good research trials came where they actually did it the right way and it didn't do anything. And so, you know, now we're not doing it. So it just kind of shows like how medicine just kind of evolves as we get information. We kind of change what we do where it was something we did fairly frequently, you know, 5-10 years before.
We're talking with Dr. Fred Buchholz. Dr. Buchholz is a SLU care general internist at SSM Health, St. Louis University Hospital. Dr. Buchholz, I saw a new study that said exercise treats depression as well as therapy. You think so?
Yeah, I think you know my answer to this one, Fred. Like exercise is never the wrong answer. So, you know, again, I think, you know, this just shows like there's a lot of kind of secondary benefits of just getting your body moving, of getting your blood pumping, and it releases a lot of different substances as you do this. So, you know, this is kind of a compendium. It's what we call a meta-analysis, but it's looking at a lot of different research that's been done and trying to kind of compile that to one answer. You know, again, when you do that, there's a lot of like concerns in the studies, and like it's hard to like kind of separate, you know, the truth. But I think in general, you can kind of say this probably has an effect. I'm not saying, I don't think if I was treating a patient with depression that I would recommend stopping medicine that I thought was essential, you know, at the expense of saying you can do that and just exercise instead. But I certainly think it's reasonable to say if you're being treated for depression, exercise probably will give you some extra benefit, and it certainly won't hurt you. Well, I mean, I guess you could get hurt exercising, but like from an overall health standpoint, there's a benefit to that. So I definitely, like I said, exercise is just never the wrong answer. It's always the right answer.
Dr. Buchholz, thanks so much for your time again this week. Really do appreciate it.
Yeah, Fred, I always appreciate it as well, too, so thank you.
Dr. Fred Buchholz is a slew care general internist at SSM Health, St. Louis University Hospital. Coming up next on Health Matters, we'll look back at the 4-year anniversary of COVID-19 being declared a pandemic. This is KMOX Health Editor Fred Bottomer. You're listening to Health Matters on KMOX.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/recommend today.
We really need new phones.
T-Mobile will cover the cost of 4 amazing new iPhone 15s, and each line is only $25 a month.
New iPhone 15s? It's better
over here. Only at T-Mobile, get 4 iPhone 15s on us and 4 lines for $25 per line per month with eligible trade-in when you switch.
Minimum of 4 lines for $25 per line per month with auto pay discount using debit or bank account. $5 more per line without auto pay, plus taxes and fees. Phone fee at 24 monthly bill credits for well qualified customers. Contact us before canceling account to continue bill credits or credit stop and balance on required finance agreement due. $35 per line connection charge applies. See T-Mobile.com.
Baseball is back, and so is MLB.tv. Watch every out-of-market, regular season game on your favorite streaming devices. Anywhere, anytime, all season long. Follow the action live or on demand. Track 4 games at once with multi-view mode and catch up with in-game highlights. Plus, original programs, minor league broadcasts, and local pre- and post-game shows. Go to MLB.tv to start your free trial today. Blackout and other restrictions apply. Major League Baseball trademarks used with permission.
Welcome back to Health Matters with Fred Bottomer on KMOX.
4 years ago this past week, the World Health Organization declared COVID-19 a pandemic.
COVID-19 can be characterized as a pandemic.
So how has the COVID of 2024 changed from the COVID of 2019? Dr. Alexander Garza is the Chief Community Health Officer for SSM Health. He's also the co-leader of the St. Louis Metropolitan Pandemic Task Force. He talked with KMOX's Amy Markscores and Chris Ranji about that.
Where are we with COVID? Because it is rarely in the news anymore.
Yeah, I mean, it's almost sort of blending into the background. I mean, of course, we still have sort of those increasing cases, but it's following the pattern now of sort of normal respiratory virus season. So, you know, how flu will kick up during the winter months, and then respiratory syncytial virus as well. So COVID is now sort of settled into that routine as well, where it becomes a little bit more predictable. We're going to see cases rise and fall, you know, depending upon the season. It's not going to ever go away. It's going to just be part of our life from here on out. So I think that's just what we're going to see going forward. There was, you know, quite a bit of transmission, I think, going on earlier in the month and in the wintertime. You know, even people that were close to me also had cases of COVID. So it was, you know, there was a fair amount of transmission. But the good news was that it wasn't then translating into people having to come into the hospital, go to the ICU, all of those different things. So it's become a much more manageable disease.
So as you look back on what we knew, what we didn't know, you know, what you were still trying to navigate at the time, how different are things now compared to what you thought might happen at the time this was really rampant?
Yeah, that's a tough question to ask because, you know, back in 2020, we didn't know a lot about it. You know, we knew the basics about what kind of virus it was. We knew sort of how it was going to be transmitted. We knew it was a respiratory virus, all of those different things. But, you know, if you think in March of 2020, that was really when it was starting to kick off. And so we didn't really have any idea on how deadly this was going to become, you know, the timeline that it was going to take to get us to where we are right now. And we got some, you know, curveballs thrown at us throughout the time, too. So, you know, if you think about how the virus has mutated over the course of those 4 years, it's gone through several different iterations to land where we are today. And it seems to be settled on the Omicron variant now. But, gosh, we had to go through at least 3 different variants to get to where we are right now. And there's no playbook for this. So, you know, this is I tell people there's been maybe 3 great pandemics in our history. You know, the bubonic plague, the 1918 influenza, and COVID-19. So whether, you know, we were unfortunate enough to live through one of the great pandemics. And so it's there's some resemblance to what has occurred on other respiratory diseases throughout history. But a lot of this was, you know, new things that we were discovering.
Can you take us back to your personal mindset when you first heard the announcement from the WHO on March 11th, 2020?
I think it was just my thought was it was just a matter of time before that announcement was going to be made. I still remember when I read my first story online about a mysterious respiratory virus in China, and having worked at the Department of Homeland Security, you know, those are one of the things that you worry about is when is the next pandemic going to start that's going to really threaten the globe. And once you started catching more and more stories coming out of China, it became more and more apparent that this had high potential to be the one that we were worried about. Now, we always thought it was going to be highly pathogenic avian influenza, and it turned out to be a coronavirus, but that was really the only difference. And then once it really got that foothold, it was really just a matter of time before it spread. I think the only questions that we had were how fast was it going to spread, and then how deadly was it going to be. But we knew eventually once it broke out of China, this is going to be a global pandemic. It's going to cause a lot of problems around the globe.
Since there has been over the years now a lot of political pushback against health measures and anti-COVID measures and, you know, vaccinations and all that stuff, how well prepared are we now for the next one, whatever the next one is?
Yeah, so I think we're better prepared. So there's a couple of ways to think about it. So I think we're better prepared from, you know, from a technology standpoint, you know, progressing out the mRNA vaccines. I mean, that was groundbreaking, and it's just amazing that we were able to put this technology together to create this vaccine in a record amount of time. So I think from that technology perspective, we're doing fairly well. From a data information gathering, so you always want to have some constant surveillance going on around the world. I think we're better. I think there's still some challenges with that, and those are geopolitical issues that you have to deal with. And as you know, we're a little bit there's some concerns around the globe with the geopolitical issues. So there's that piece. But in reference to your sort of the social and you know, some political dynamics as well to public health measures and vaccine, it's I think we're still dealing with a lot of that fallout from some of those very contested issues during the pandemic. And we're witnessing that now with other communicable diseases, such as measles that is breaking out in Florida and other parts of the country, and vaccine hesitancy. And, you know, it's entered into the political realm, really what should just be a public health and science-based advice is really turned into more of a social and political issue, which is unfortunate.
Along those lines, the social political aspect, and just how there seemed to be a lack of cohesion across the country when it came to, you know, uniting to fight this virus. I think what exacerbated that was that it wasn't like 9/11, a tragedy where we all know how we felt. We all know where we were. COVID and the reality of COVID pandemic life was so different depending on where you lived. So someone in rural Missouri probably experienced COVID a lot differently with a lot more freedom than someone, say, in New York. My brother-in-law lived in Manhattan. He said it was like being in prison. They had a refrigerator truck outside his apartment, which was being used. And so his experience was very different than mine, which was spent, you know, out in the countryside, you know, the rural Missouri. Does that also play into how seriously people took the pandemic?
Yeah, probably some aspect of it. You know, one of the other things I tell people is this is if you compare this to like conflict. And so I think, as you know, I'm a 20-year veteran in the Army. I've deployed to conflicts overseas. But the ask that you make of the population during armed conflict is not that great, to be honest. I mean, there's 1% of the population that serves in the military, and they carry a lot of the burden, them and their families. But the global pandemic took a toll on everybody. I mean, it didn't matter who you were. You were going to be impacted by this pandemic. And so depending upon your frame of reference really impacted how you viewed it as well. And so to your point, you know, somebody that's living in a different environment, a different political environment as well, is going to have a different experience than somebody that's living in a, you know, an urban environment or some other place. But I would emphasize as well. So one of the things I talk about also is one of the things that we didn't have before is the social media piece. And I'm not saying social media was the sole, you know, source of all of our issues, but clearly when information is disseminated at a very rapid rate, even if it's wrong, it still gets disseminated very quickly. And so half of our challenge during COVID was really dispelling, you know, disinformation and you know, people just spreading bad advice about public health measures. And so it created a lot of issues that people have never had to deal with before, either with a conflict or with a pandemic.
Dr. Garza with us right now on KMOX. Why do we have measles again?
Yeah, so it's usually imported into the country. So because we have fairly high vaccination rates, but the issue is you have continued transmission then, and that is because there's vaccine hesitancy out in the community. And so if you have majority of the people, you know, it's that herd immunity effect where the transmission is going to stop because it's got nowhere to go. But if there is a segment of the population that's not vaccinated, then it does have somewhere to go. So it's imported into the country, but it finds an available host. And so that's how the chain is able to keep going. And it's unfortunate because you know, measles vaccine is extremely effective. But with vaccine hesitancy, there's just more opportunity to spread.
We've got like 15 seconds left, but I've been vaccinated. Mm-hmm. Should people who are vaccinated for measles be worried?
Should people that were vaccinated against measles be worried about the spread of measles?
Yeah, like, can I get it if I've already been vaccinated?
Yeah,
I'm really asking for me.
Yeah, I got you. Okay. So if you've been vaccinated and you know, kept up to date on all your vaccines, you should have no reason to be worried, not at all.
Dr. Alexander Garza is the Chief Community Health Officer for SSM Health. He's also the co-leader of the St. Louis Metropolitan Pandemic Task Force. Coming up next on Health Matters, we'll hear about colorectal cancer screening. This is KMOX Health Editor Fred Bottomer. You're listening to Health Matters on KMOX.
Welcome back to Health Matters with Fred Bottomer on KMOX.
March is National Colorectal Cancer Awareness Month. Here to talk with us about that is Dr. Lisa Richardson. Dr. Richardson is director of the CDC's Division of Cancer Prevention and Control. Dr. Richardson, thanks a lot for joining us again.
Well, thanks for having us.
So what trends are we seeing right now when it comes to colorectal cancer in the U.S.?
So overall, in the older age groups, the trends we're seeing is that colorectal cancer incidence and deaths are going down because of colorectal cancer screening. and better treatment. So that's why we're here today in Colorectal Cancer Awareness Month to share with people about what they need to do with screening and why it's important.
What about the rise among young and middle-aged people in colorectal cancer?
So what we're seeing in younger folk is that you're absolutely correct. When we look at the data over the last 10 to 15 years, there seems to be an increased number of cancers in younger people. And what we, you know, what we're doing there really is trying to figure out why that is. We're not sure. But again, to raise awareness that this is something that's going on and that people should be aware of symptoms that could be cancer and pay attention and go to see their provider if that should occur.
What are some of the symptoms of colorectal cancer?
Well, most people with colorectal cancer won't have any symptoms, but among those who do, they are a change in how your, you know, your bowel habits are. Is it more, are the stools more loose, more pencil-like, blood in or on the stool, abdominal pain, unexplained weight loss? So as you see, these symptoms are kind of nonspecific. And so if they persist, let's say over 2 weeks to a month, you should see someone and have, you know, have be examined and make sure everything is okay because they are so nonspecific. And most of the things that could cause this aren't cancer, but you can never be sure and you have to stay on top of it.
Let's talk a little bit about colorectal cancer screening. At what age should we start now and why is it so critical for people to do that?
Well, I'll start with why it's so critical. It's critical because, again, most people don't have symptoms. And secondarily, it's because colon cancer screening can prevent cancer if we find things called polyps and take them out. Those are the things that usually lead to the cancer. And that's why cancer screening for colon cancer is so important, because we can prevent it. The age to start used to be 50. So there's confusion now about, you know, when to start. It's actually 45 now, 45 and older. And so, and we recommend older, you know, the older ages are where we have the most evidence that screening works, is that people are asymptomatic and don't have a family history, so you can't rely upon that.
If I have no family history of colorectal disease, do I still need to be screened?
Absolutely. The number one risk factor is getting older. And as we get older, cancers are more happen more frequently, and that's why we start at 45 for that. If you have a family history, and we do really encourage people to ask, because if there's a family history, the testing may be different, the intervals of screening may be different, and you just really need to know what goes on with your family history, no matter what, but cancer, for colon cancer in particular.
How important is early detection to treating colorectal cancer?
Well, early detection is very important. So when you say early detection, that's if we find the cancer small. At that point, let's say the stages are like, you know, stages 1, 2, 3, and 4. If we find it at a stage 1, it's 90% curable. And so that's why we encourage people to go find it early. And if it's there, there's a very high chance that you could be cured.
We're talking with Dr. Lisa Richardson. Dr. Richardson is director of the CDC's Division of Cancer Prevention and Control. Dr. Richardson, what questions should I ask my doctor about this?
Well, when you, you know, as you, the reason we're raising awareness is so that you'll know when to, you know, start asking questions. And so at 45 or so, ask, you know, ask your provider, is this something that you need? You have to be your own advocate and go, you know, go, if people aren't talking to you about it, need to bring it up. What tests do we recommend? There are several. One is the blood test for the stool, and that one can be done at home. And the other most popular test is the colonoscopy, which has a light on the end that the doctor looks in your colon to find those polyps that I discussed earlier, or to find the cancers, do a biopsy and take the, you know, find the cancer and follow up. Really important to know what the next steps are. So if your, you know, fecal occult blood test for the stool is positive, you have to move on to a colonoscopy. The reason we offer choices, it may seem a little weird because everything ends up with a colonoscopy, and some people really don't want it, really don't want that test, and the blood test for the stool is a perfectly fine test and recommended as well.
What can you say to people that have always feared getting a colonoscopy?
Well, first thing I would say is the colonoscopy, regardless of why you need it, is a test that has almost no side effects. The worst part of the whole process is cleaning the colon out the night before. And we do have some, you know, stuff that we use now that's a little bit less harsh when you're doing the bowel prep. I don't know if you've experienced that. And really, when you go there, you know, you'll get a sedative. They won't do anesthesia usually unless there's something else going on. But you get a sedative and to relax you. And most people don't remember that they even had the test done until they wake up and somebody tells them what the results are. So I don't know what your experience has been, but that truly is, you know, it's not something to be scared of.
That's exactly what my experience was. I apologized to the doctors for whatever they were about to see. And next thing I knew, I was waking up and it was all over and it was a good report. So very
simple. Absolutely. And that's what I mean.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, very simple for me. Tell us about some prevention methods.
So prevention in colorectal cancer really is, you know, the scope where you find the polyps that, you know, that works. But prevention is really what you do just to maintain a healthy lifestyle, you know, being physically active, eating a healthy diet. Believe it or not, smoking is related to colon cancer. So if you smoke, you should quit for all, you know, all lots of reasons, but for colon cancer as well. And, you know, maintaining a normal body weight, not, you know, becoming overweight or having obesity. Those are all things we can all do that work to prevent colon cancer.
Dr. Richardson, tell us where we can get more information about colorectal cancer screening and tell us about the Screen for Life campaign.
So Screen for Life is our campaign to raise awareness about colon cancer. It provides information for people about getting regularly screened. It also has information there about talking with your family, talking with your provider, asking those questions that you asked about before. And it's at cdc.gov/screenforlife.
Dr. Richardson, thanks so much for your time today. Really appreciate it.
Well, thank you so much.
Dr. Lisa Richardson is director of the CDC's Division of Cancer Prevention and Control. Coming up next on Health Matters, we'll take a closer look at actress Olivia Munn's battle with breast cancer and the test used to alert her to it. This is KMOX Health Editor Fred Bottomer. You're listening to Health Matters on KMOX.
Welcome back to Health Matters with Fred Bottomer on KMOX.
Actress Olivia Munn revealed this past week that she was diagnosed with breast cancer last year and underwent four surgeries in the last 10 months, including a double mastectomy. Olivia was diagnosed with an aggressive form in both breasts, despite testing negative for all cancer genes in a genetic test and having just had a normal mammogram. She only found her cancer, she says, because her OBGYN calculated her breast cancer risk assessment score at 37%. So she ordered an MRI, ultrasound, and biopsy. We find out more about this test from Dr. Alisa Port. Dr. Port is the chief of breast surgery at Mount Sinai Health System in New York City. She talked with the host of CBS Mornings.
I had never heard of this breast cancer risk assessment tool. It's something we should all be aware of, it seems. I'd never heard of this.
Definitely, Gail. I mean, I think the most important thing is empowering patients to know about their individual risk. Most women, the average risk of getting breast cancer in their lifetime is about 10 to 12%. Mm-hmm. And then on the other far end of the spectrum are women who carry genetic predisposition, and their risk is about 60 to 80%. That's the highest risk.
But she had all these positive tests, though, Alisa.
She had all of the negative, the genetic
negative. Yeah, that everything turned
out
negative is what I mean.
The issue is that there's a lot of risk in between 10 and 80%. And the question is, how do you figure out what your risk is? And there are other factors that weigh in, separate from genetic predisposition, like just having a family history or having prior breast biopsies that shows some funny-looking cells called atypical cells. These are all things that a lot of women don't know can drive up their risk for getting breast cancer and could lead to the concept of added screening, which it seems like Olivia had and detected her breast cancer.
So how do you measure this score, or how do you calculate this? We've put up some of the tools on the screen, but what is it, a checklist, or is it an actual physical test?
It's actually, and there's a few of them. Just so you know, there are different risk models. You can go online and do this. It's like a survey, a yes or no survey, and it asks you a number of different questions. Questions related to your family history, questions related to whether or not you've had a breast biopsy or not and what it showed. questions related to your reproductive history. What age did, as a woman, start getting her period? What age did she have children? Believe it or not, the reproductive factors have less of an effect overall than the other factors on pushing your risk higher. The two big ones that really push your risk higher are having a family history, which most women know about already. Remember, the risk assessment tool is important. It's very helpful to spit out a quantifiable number, but most women should know already, if they have a family history of breast cancer, that they're at higher risk than the average population.
But so many people who don't have a family history of breast cancer are still getting breast cancer.
That's exactly true, so, and none of us is not at risk. 85 to 90% of women, Gail, as you point out, who get breast cancer have no family history. And so we're all at risk, and that's why when people come in and say, you know, I didn't think to get my mammogram, even though I'm 45 or 50, when the starting age is 40, that's the recommended guidelines for the general population, and women say, I didn't think to do these general screening tests because I didn't think I was at risk. But even the average woman's risk with no other risk factors, her risk is 10 to 12% over her lifetime. That's enough to be doing the appropriate screening tests.
Well, people who are hearing Olivia's story today, what should we be doing?
I think all women should be empowered. Know your risk. And whether that's going online by yourself or going to a doctor who can run this algorithm for you, those things will all give you a better idea of what you should be doing to be proactive about your health.
Dr. Elisa Port is the chief of breast surgery at Mount Sinai Health System in New York City. A team of experts from the Centers for Disease Control has arrived in Chicago to help manage a measles outbreak there. Most of the cases, which are highly contagious in the unvaccinated, were diagnosed in a migrant shelter. We find out more about this story from Fox News chief medical correspondent, Dr. Mark Siegel.
For measles, you feel initially malaise, fever. You get those red eyes, which we don't talk about much anymore. And then about 4 or 5 days later, headache, fever, cough, you can get pneumonia. Then you develop this characteristic bright red rash. That's measles. And measles, by the way, is the most highly contagious respiratory virus on the planet. And here's the stark medicine of this. If you are vaccinated, you are almost 100% not going to get measles. If you are not vaccinated against measles and you encounter it, there's almost 100% chance you are going to get measles. That's the problem. Now, the head of the CDC, Mandy Cohen, told me last week that we're about at 93% in the United States. I think it's lower now. That was a year ago. We've had so much vaccine, anti-vax sentiment here that measles vaccination rate among our children is dropping. Here's why that number is important. You know what the number is for herd immunity? A term we bandied around a lot during the pandemic. Herd immunity is 95 or 96%. In other words, if the whole herd is vaccinated, 96% of us, then we're going to protect the others who can't get it because they're immunocompromised or because they're pregnant or because they have chronic diseases. We are not at 96% now, and that's why Chicago is at risk. In addition to the fact, one more point here, Dana, I don't think the issue of migrants and measles is political. I'll tell you why. Because if you're coming across the southern border, you're coming from a country that's 85 to 90% vaccinated. On top of that, you think if you're rushing across the border or you're trying to escape somewhere, you're actually going to pause to get a vaccination? I don't think you're going to do that.
Okay, let me ask you something, though, because apparently now at these shelters in Chicago, or at this one, they are providing vaccines to people there. So how quickly can you become protected from measles if you get a vaccine today? And then does that, if you're an adult, does that help protect you for the rest of your life?
Yeah, I knew you were going to ask me that question because you always ask the best questions. The answer is 13% of the people in that shelter needed the vaccine. So that's the 87% rate. And it actually will help. So within about a 4 to 5 days to a week, it will offer a level of protection. Now, measles can be a prodrome of up to 21 days. So this isn't 100% perfect, but it's going to help. And the answer is yes, lifetime immunity is what we think. Two shots give you about 97, 98% lifetime immunity. One shot, about 91 to 93%. I check titers because if I'm in a place where I think measles could have an outbreak, I want to see if it's worn off, and then I give a booster.
Fox News Chief Medical Correspondent Dr. Mark Siegel talking with Fox News anchor Dana Perino. And that's all the time we have for this week's show. Thanks so much for listening. I really do appreciate it. If there are parts of this show you want to hear again, please log on to KMOX.com and look under the podcast section. Or you can download the Odyssey app and favorite KMOX. This is KMOX Health Editor Fred Bottomer. Please join me again next week for another edition of Health Matters on the Voice of St. Louis, KMOX.
T-Mobile has invested billions to light up America's largest 5G network from big cities to small towns, including right here in yours. And great coverage is just the beginning. Right now, families and small businesses can save up to 20% versus AT&T and Verizon when they switch. Visit your local T-Mobile store today.
Plan savings with three lines of T-Mobile Essentials versus comparable available plans. Plan features and taxes and fees may vary.
Now, with the MLB app, you can get baseball your way. Pick your favorite team, your favorite players, and get customized highlights, stories, and breaking news right on your home feed. Follow the action with Game Tip, where 3D replays add another dimension. Plus, notifications can keep you connected to every pitch, every hit, every game. The MLB app. Baseball, your way. Download it now for free from the App Store or Google Play. Blackout and other restrictions apply. Major League Baseball trademarks used with permission.